Glory Kid. Of Retronauts, starring me and other people who are not me. I'm Jeremy Parrish. The other people are
Ben Edwards,
Ben Elgin.
Nice try, Lauche.
That's not your name. I see. Okay. I see how it's going to be. You're going to be one of those guys this time. The wise guy.
I'm always one of those guys, Jeremy. It's been a while for this.
So, hi, everyone. We're revisiting a topic that we tackled last year, Raiders of the Lost Ark. And naturally enough, we're moving along to the sequel, or rather the prequel, but whatever, it's the sequel. It's Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. The movie is so good that they had to change the entire American movie rating system for it. That's how good it was. Yeah. It's an interesting movie because it has some problems, and I know Binge doesn't think we should talk about problems in movies based on current standards when they're 35 years old. And that's a fair argument, but I personally disagree. And guess what? I'm running the show. Oh, yeah.
That's okay.
I don't know. I'm pretty sure we knew that racism was bad in the mid-80s.
Yeah. I mean, right. if you watch movies that are directed by black directors in the 80s, they sure do call that stuff out. I mean, even Blazing Saddles calls out racism in Hollywood. And that's the 70s.
74.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm. We should do a Blazing Saddles podcast, except there were no video games. But, you know, it is difficult to talk about this movie and not address that. Although, not only is the cultural context of 1984 important to understand this movie, but also the cultural context of when this movie was set, which was 1935 and the waning days of the British Empire. So, all of that factors in there as well. But that's not really the focus on here, because Temple of Doom was a very influential movie, sometime in some senses a good influence, and in some senses a bad influence. But it definitely is an interesting follow-up to Raiders of the Lost Ark, and therefore merits discussion. And also, there were some video games based on it. And by golly, that means we get to talk about it on Retronauts. So everyone, buckle in. This mine car is going off the rails.
Whoa. Cover your heart.
Very authentic. You sounded just like Willie.
Yeah. Oh, God. I can't do that without getting shot.
All right. So Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom was the highly anticipated follow-up to Indiana Jones. Originally it was just Raiders of the Lost Ark. They added the Indiana Jones later. And it came 3 years later, just like George Lucas and did all of his Star Wars movies, a three-year gap in between. And naturally, it once again starred Harrison Ford, was directed by Steven Spielberg. The story was conceived and planned by George Lucas, written by some other people whose names I didn't write down. Did I write them down? I didn't write them down. No. But basically, it's a Lucas concept. And you could kind of see the Star Wars, like the shape the Star Wars prequels would take forming here. Like there's some hints of the future for sure. But there is some good stuff here. Certainly, I respect the fact that this movie has a lot of sexiness to it, and most of the sexiness is directed at Indy as opposed to Kate Capshaw, the co-star, the female co-star. Like, she wears a revealing bodice in much of the movie, but really the focus is on the fact that Harrison Ford gained about 30 pounds of muscle after Raiders of the Lost Ark, and it's basically just a slab of sexy man beef.
There's a lot of wet Harrison Ford.
He spends a lot of time without a shirt on.
There's a lot of strategic taking off of shirts. Yeah,
it does. The effect does lose something because once again, Harrison Ford became badly injured while filming this movie, and you can definitely see it. Like, he gets around in a very awkward way in some of the action scenes, or some of the scenes that aren't like pure action, but are just like him moving around the stage. Like, you can see something. And for a while I was like, did he, you know, watching this again for this podcast, I was like, did he like get really out of shape? Cause he's huge. So I couldn't tell if he was like beefed up or just like kind of let himself go from all the cocaine benders and marijuana and heavy drinking he did with Carrie Fisher. But no, he's like super, super muscular. It's just that he totally screwed up his body again, like he does in all these action movies of the past.
What did he do?
Yeah, what happened?
I don't remember exactly what it was, but he just like pulled something in his back, and you can definitely see like there's some real awkwardness to the way he kind of moves around sometimes.
That's kind of very appropriate for old Henry Jones Jr., though.
Oh yeah. I mean, it just reminds you that if Indiana Jones were a real human being, he would basically be like,
shambling.
Like, you know, like Batman in the Dark Knight Rises, where he has like no cartilage left in his body. That would be Indiana Jones.
This movie is the closest that Harrison Ford gets to that Jim Steranko concept art.
Definitely.
Big square jawed pulp novel cover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he really bulked up in the early 80s and then kind of let that taper off and became less of an action movie star and more of just like a drama star. But for a while, he was just like, watch how big I can get. And this movie really shows that up. I didn't mean to talk so much about Harrison Ford's body in this, but it's out there. It's like front and center. Watching it on the big screen or in high definition, you're like, Harrison Ford's body. Okay, I got it.
Well, he also gets like a lot of, there's a lot more variation in this one because we get
in
like
his body.
Well, in the way he looks, right? Because we get kind of the James Bond.
Yeah, he starts out as James Bond.
Yeah, the tuxedo kind of thing.
Yeah.
Classic, classic hat and jacket indie. Then we get shirtless indie bit.
And then you get just the shirt indie. Yeah.
And that shirt is very unbuttoned.
Yeah.
Extremely unbuttoned. There's a lot more cleavage from Harrison Ford than from Kate Capshaw, let's just say.
Yeah, very much.
All right. So I think, in other words, this is a movie with a little something for everyone. Whether you are
whether you like
pretty ladies or beefy men or both,
or
this
racism.
Movie's got you covered. Yeah. Or racism, but what can you do? Yeah, this was, like I said, a prequel to Raiders of the Lost Ark, and therefore there are no returning characters besides Indiana Jones himself. It's the only movie that Marcus Brody doesn't show up in. Is that right? Or does he show up in Kingdom of the Crystal Skulls? Was he dead by then?
I don't know what movie that is.
It's the one with the ants.
I don't think he is.
It's the one with the Transformer guy.
I don't know what you're talking about.
The one-hour jungle chase scene thing or whatever.
I did watch that, but I don't remember if he's in it or not.
There's a fridge. It's great.
Yeah.
Doesn't sound like any movie I've ever heard of or want to acknowledge the existence of.
I mean, people can talk trash about Kingdom of the Crystal Skulls, but I feel like the real treasure was knowledge is no better or worse than I understand their power now. Like, Temple of Doom, I think, sets a precedent for Kingdom of the Crystal Skulls, which is sometimes enjoyable and sometimes, Indiana Jones.
When we talked about Raiders, I talked about how my evaluation of Raiders as a perfect movie. Like, it's so good and so, like, everything fits together like clockwork. It does the best job of recapturing the serial aesthetic of moving from one set piece to the next and connecting them all and telling this one grand adventure and then killing a bunch of Nazis at the end, which is the best way to end a movie, I think.
In fairness, there's a lot of Nazis getting killed along the way.
Yes, yes.
And I'm fully in support of that also.
Yes. And I think Last Crusade is a personal favorite movie of mine. Like, it was, I saw that in the theater when I was 7. So it was a big...
You were a baby.
Yeah, aww. I know. It was a big, movie for me. And I still think it holds up pretty well. The interplay between Sean Connery and Harrison Ford, I think, is
absolutely
very choice.
Spectacular.
I think Alison Duty as Elsa Schneider is a very good foil for Indy. Temple of Doom is bad. Temple of Doom is a bad movie.
It has parts that are good and parts that are bad.
It's technically well made.
Except the parts with the crocodiles. Those edits at the end with the crocodiles, those are really bad.
Those are very bad.
Yeah, but there are some very good edits, like you know, the some like ironic juxtapositions, like the Indiana Jones closing the plane door and it reveals Lao She. But also when Willie Capshaw is like, "You'll always remember tonight. It's the night I slipped right through your fingers," and it cuts to Indy being strangled and reaching out, and there's like a shadow being cast of his fingers
that
on the door.
Corny as hell.
I love so that. Corny. I think it's so good. It's funny.
This movie corny. Never gets like better than the opening sequence. From like the
literal, but that like, is that's a top 10 sequence right
there. Did you know
the whole musical number of Anything Goes up to closing the door and saying "Nice try, Lao She," and the reveal on the door. That's perfect.
Did you know, though, that Lawrence Kasdan has said that he wrote that whole sequence in the beginning? The guy who wrote Raiders of the Lost Ark wrote that.
That's unsurprising.
They snipped it out of his original thing and just tacked it on, didn't give him any credit for it.
Just like, that's kind of seemed like a different movie. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's why it's totally different and good.
Well, because I think what Temple of Doom is trying to do, and if not failing at, is doing it a lot less successfully than Raiders does, is it's also trying to echo the adventure serials, right?
But it doesn't hang together as well. Like it.
But where Raiders tells one continuous story that moves from set piece to set piece, Temple of Doom kind of goes and tries to bring in other stuff from the 30s and 40s, like the big musical number and like the
quote-unquote
exotic locations, which led to colonialism and Orientalism. And
which still, I think, you know, whatever problems you may have with the way the indigenous peoples are presented in this movie, it still is very much kind of relevant and timely to the setting. So I understand why it happened that way.
Yeah, I mean, it's sympathetic to their plight, but it's still not a great portrayal.
I just always think about the scene where Indy is talking to Willie, who, by the way, Willie's also not a great character. Like,
no, she's
Willie's bad.
Bad.
She's
There's very no chemistry. Yeah.
Like, Kate Capshaw, I think, could have done much better. I don't think she could have done, like, as well as Karen Allen does as Marion. But, like, that character is rough. But I always think about the part where Indy tells her, "You're insulting them and you're embarrassing me." And I'm like, that's Indy talking to the filmmakers as well.
So,
let's talk about the premise, because I can tell you exactly why this movie's horrible. Well, but I don't want to get into it yet.
I just want to jump on something Chris said, and this is something that I kind of dawned on me as I was watching this over the past couple of days to prepare for this podcast. You know, in Raiders of the Lost Ark, the film culminates at the Nazi base. And you spend like 10, maybe 15 minutes there between like in the sub base and then in the theater above that where they finally open the Ark. The entire second half of Temple of Doom takes place in the equivalent, which is the Temple of Pankot Palace and then the catacombs underneath. Actually, more than that. It's like an hour and 10 minutes out of an hour and 50 minute running time. So most of the movie takes place in one area. And it just feels really oppressive. Like everything feels kind of stuck there. And I get in terms of the narrative why that had to happen. But like I would not have enjoyed Raiders of the Lost Ark nearly as much if it had spent the second half of its running time in the Nazi base, the sub base. Like that would not have been good or interesting.
Yeah, it lacks the movement of Raiders and of Last Crusade, where, you know, Raiders goes from place to place and Temple of Doom goes to a place and stays there.
Yeah, Temple of Doom, like, they get to Pankot Palace after, like, I don't know, 45 minutes, and then it just kind of stays there. And instead of getting, like, lots of rambling, you know, you never know where you're going to go next kind of adventures, it's like you're in the mines, you're in the temple, you're having a gross-out food scene that was basically just ripped off from the Dark Crystal, except more racist. And, yeah, it stagnates, I think, is the big problem. The finger part is really funny, though.
Yeah, well...
So did you want to talk about...
There's a lot of trite elements to this film. There's the triteness of the food scene. There's the triteness of the minecart chase. There's the triteness of what you're talking about, like that thing where he's reaching for the shadow and it happens to be what she's talking about. That's stupid.
No, that's good. It's good.
And there's the little
Indiana Jones does that ironic juxtaposition all the time.
Short Round, the cute Asian sidekick, you know, and then Willie is just the most horrible thing about this entire movie is she screams the whole damn time and you just want her to shut up because it's horrible. And I don't know how that started. Like, was Steven Spielberg married her eventually later, right?
Yeah, that's why I think that's why there's no chemistry between her and Indy because she's like, hey, Steven.
Yeah, so
Steven's like, oh, yeah.
I was just thinking about this last night. I was like, did Steven Spielberg like seeing her scream the whole time? Is this why he said, oh, more screaming. Come on, Kate. More screaming. You can do it.
And she's just, every stereotypical thing for her to do, she does. Yeah, she's afraid of the animals. She's afraid of the food. She only cares about the diamond. Like, from the very beginning,
she
only cares about the diamond because that's because, you know, women love diamonds. Although, to that scene's credit, the gag with the diamond and the ice, that was actually funny.
I think... Again, I think she's clearly a throwback character, right? Like, she's clearly that, you know, the 1930s Dale Arden
Jill of the Jungle
character.
Kind of.
Yes. But I think she's meant to be so far over the top that it's comedy, but she never quite gets there. She's not, like, they don't land that gag at all. And the result is that Willie's really bad.
Yeah, I think a big part of the problem is that she never has a really functional role in the script beyond being like a victim. Whereas Marion, she would like clobber dudes in the back of the head while they were trying to beat up Indy or something. Yeah, like
Willie did punch one guy at the end of the movie. I was like, thank God she at least got one. But it was way too late.
She managed to reach past some bugs and pull a lever.
Yeah, that's true.
And then she caused the trap to activate all over.
Anyways,
I think that like. The reason you can tell she's supposed to be like lampooning that stereotype, she literally talks about breaking a nail at one point. Like that's her big problem. Uh-huh.
She puts the most passion into that line more than any other line in the movie. And I broke a nail,
but
like Batman, she's intense.
but instead of like satirizing the stereotype, it just is the stereotype. And that really, given how good Marion's just her introduction is in Raiders, like it is a like why wouldn't they try to do that kind of character again?
Yeah, I mean they start out with you know the famous Paramount mountain dissolve, only this time it's to a giant gong, and this you know large Asian man hits the gong, and you're like, wow, what's going on? There's this red light glowing from some sort of mysterious sculpture. And you're like, is this a strange exotic temple in the jungles? What's happening? And then Kate Capshaw steps out in a sequin dress and starts singing Anything Goes in Chinese. It's so good.
I really like that scene.
No, that scene, I agree. It's perfect. It's so unexpected because you go into, you know, after watching Raiders, you go into it expecting one thing. And it kind of plays off the cues. And the whole movie plays off cues and jokes from Raiders to various degrees of success. But that one, I think, is one of the more subtle ones because it's not so much an overt reference as more like playing up expectations and then shifting them and saying, oh, this is something else entirely. Suddenly it's not like a threatening opening. It's a very fun opening. But then it becomes threatening over the course of the conversation. Very James Bond.
I know why they didn't do the same character, Marion. It's because it was written by different people.
Also, it's a prequel.
Yeah, but also, I mean, the whatever Lawrence Kasdan had going in his head. I mean, this is the dude who wrote The Empire Strikes Back. You know, this guy is awesome. And so he wrote Raiders of the Lost Ark, and it's great. But some other people came in and wrote the rest of the Temple of Doom after the original, you know, segment that we were just talking about. So they may have not had the same sense for an interesting female character as, you know, Lawrence Kasdan did.
Well, I mean, one of the co-writers was a woman, so...
It doesn't matter. I mean, women can do stereotypes just as well as men. Doesn't have any, you know...
That's very advanced of you.
Yeah. I mean, progressive. It's a personal thing. However they view of writing a story is different.
I feel like the most charitable read of Willie is that she's a joke. And then that's also kind of the least charitable read of Willie. Right.
But it's just hard to believe that there's anything like any kind of connection there besides Indy just wants to, you know, have a quick lay, basically.
If you take Willie out of the plot, the movie doesn't change.
Right.
If you take
except they die in the spike room, but They can find some other mechanism.
If you take Short Round out of the plot, then everything Short Round does can be done by Willy, and everything Willy does can be done by Short Round. Like, you don't really need both of them, and Short Round, for all of his flaws, and I like Jonathan Kwan as a, you know, I grew up in the 80s. I think he's really fun, but why is Willy in the plot?
Right. I think basically they were trying to recapture the Raiders dynamic where you had Indy, you had Marion, and you had Sala. And so they...
I had never thought about him being
They basically
character.
Take Sala and make him a kid, and they, like, take Marion's flintiness and transfer it onto Short Round, where he's, like, the really tough one. And Sala was kind of like... Sala was, you know, like, the fixer. He could get stuff done, but he was not an action star. And they kind of transfer that onto Willy, except they forgot to bring the fixer part over, so she doesn't have anything going for her. They, like, drained all of the important stuff from Marion and put it in Short Round.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, he basically is the sidekick character. He's Sala, but he's a kid. And I don't actually... I can't think of what the problems are with Short Round. He's a great character.
I don't think he's a, like, capital P problematic character. I do think it's weird that Indy has... acquired a boy who then vanishes.
Well, he has all these allies. He also has the guy at the beginning of the movie who's masquerading as a waiter and has the gun.
That's
so
right.
So he just, like, has allies it's different places. Network, yeah.
Which is kind of a, like, going back to pulp and cereal roots, like, that's kind of a shadow thing, right?
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So I don't see any kind of weird relationship there or, you know, any untowardness.
I don't think it's untoward. I just think it's odd that he has this sidekick character that's never explained, but you know, I also need an explanation.
You know, he found him on the streets of Shanghai where he was living as an orphan as a pickpocket and was like, hey kid, you're pretty good at this, want to make an honest living instead?
An honest living driving my escape car from a shootout.
Put some boxes on your feet and drive my car for me.
Indy's a bad teacher.
He's a very bad teacher. I mean, that's actually text in some of the parts they took out where, you know, in the first movie, he was going to be, like, having inappropriate relationships with some of his students. So he's not a good guy. And I feel like you don't really ever see that, like, this kind of, like, kind of sleazy playboy side of Indy, except in, like, the dance club scene kind of gets to it. Because, you know, then he's got the James Bond thing going on. He's wearing the white silk tux and everything. And he's kind of debonair and he's got all these allies and... You know, he's kind of devil may care, drink the champagne without checking to see if it's poison first.
I think that's because Harrison Ford's too likable. You know, like I can imagine them filming that and seeing it and being like, oh, this doesn't work because this guy is, like, really affable and
a
vulnerable
character. The scenes where he's kind of creepy to Willy in this, like even the ending with the where he, like, snags her with a whip and pulls her in for the kiss. Oof. Like, it just, it doesn't quite work. I feel like that was the vision that probably would have worked with Burt Reynolds as Indiana Jones.
Maybe.
Like laying naked and hairy there. Yeah. Like,
imagine this movie, but it's Burt Reynolds as Indy, Sally Field as Willy, and Dom DeLuise as Short Round.
That's great.
Or Jerry Reed.
I'd watch that.
Using the magic of technology, we can now make that happen.
I think we should.
Yeah. And now I'm wondering, like, what Short Round Steel is. Like, who is the worst guardian for, like, young wards? Is it Indiana Jones or Batman?
We don't know what happens to Short Round by the time Raiders roll
around. I really want him to be an Indy 5. If they actually go ahead and do that, like, bring back Jonathan Kwan. Let's see what happens. Where is he in life now?
I would rather watch a movie about him carrying on Indy's legacy in the 60s
than Shia LaBeouf.
Well, Ben, what do you think about all this? I don't know if we gave you a chance to talk at all.
We still haven't explained the context, of the movie.
Sorry. So what's the concept, Ben?
lay it out for us.
Yeah, lay it out.
That's way too broad. Should we just, like, go from the beginning? I don't know. We were talking about, about good and bad indie movies earlier, and it's really, like, I feel like this does presage some of the stuff that didn't work in the movie that Chris doesn't want to acknowledge.
He just did. Like, he mentioned a certain name.
It's true. He did.
I just, I heard they were making that one, but I don't think they ever did.
But you know, just like the not hanging together and the just going for set pieces for the sake of set pieces, like falling out of an airplane in a rubber raft and surviving strikes me as like just a tick less ridiculous than surviving a nuclear explosion in a refrigerator.
Yeah, that's like, what I was saying earlier was like the bad stuff that people complain about in Kingdom of the Crystal Skulls, like it all is right here.
Yeah.
So I guess let me give a quick rundown of this movie now that we're 25 minutes into the podcast. So this is, you know, again, the prequel to Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's set about, what is it, like, what year did Raiders take place? Was it like 38, 37?
Yeah, something like that.
So this is 1935, so it's a few years before Raiders. And it starts out with Indy trying to make an exchange of the cremains of a Chinese emperor for some sort of rare diamond. And that goes south. So he escapes and drags along a singer who was at the club with him who got caught up in everything, and his assistant, Short Round, who is a Chinese orphan that he kind of fell into the orbit of Indiana Jones and is his driver and so forth. And they escape by plane, but the plane is owned by the guy that they had the bad deal with. So the pilots of the plane jump out, you know, they abandon ship, empty the fuel tanks, and the plane crashes. So they jump out, fall in a river, land in a river, like I said, and that takes them downstream to a town in India where people have stolen the mystical stones that keep the grounds fertile or whatever. And also they stole all the children. And so Indy and his retinue go to the nearby palace where the bad guys are based and have an adventure, stop the revival of the thuggy cult from spreading across the world and conquering the planet, and save the children and bring back the Senka stones. Good to the last drop.
Yeah.
So now you know.
Because there's a whole D&D dungeon under the palace.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. With a river of lava.
With magma. That seems very, very architecturally unstable.
It's like, great in the winter.
20 miles of minecart tracks.
It was hard to heat those old drafty palaces though. So yeah, having that magma there could be real handy.
So the premise there for the mines is that basically there are five mystic stones called the Shankara stones that are tied to the god Shiva, and the thuggy cult that follows the teachings of Kali want to claim the Shankara stones and use their mystical power to conquer the world. But when the British destroyed the thuggy cult in the 19th century, a loyal priest hid two of the stones in the mines beneath the palace. So now the priest of Kali, Mola Ram, is enslaving children to dig one for gems to finance their new empire and their world conquest, and also the two missing Shankara stones because they have three of them. So he's like a dude on a MacGuffin quest. He's like Thanos, but with more blood drinking and a better laugh. And so Indy gets caught up in that and saves the kids.
What do the Shankara stones do? Because the one of them
glow.
Is like...
Yeah, it's never really clear.
The one of them that they have in the village is like...
They blow.
Making the crops go.
It's basically just a mystic stone with a tie to their vibes. Patron god.
Okay.
I mean, Shiva was the destroyer god, but Shiva was also like an icy lady with no clothes on.
Yeah, that's
but true. Also, wait, that's not canon. Okay, but also
it's all
like
cyclical.
Yeah, the gods of the Indian pantheon have many facets, and so Shiva was also like a protector, a warrior.
I'm not a YouTube channel pointing out plot holes.
Tell us about the sins of the cinema, Chris.
Yeah, I just, you know, is it ever really established, like, why the bad guys need the Shankara stones? Because they seem to have, like, mind control and heart ripping down at this point.
They don't, but, I mean, why did Hitler really need the Lost Ark?
Yeah.
As a radio to God, I mean...
Well, I mean, historically, Jeremy, he lost, so...
Yeah. He wanted to take over the world. These guys just want to take over the children, don't they?
No, they want to take over the world eventually.
They do?
Yeah,
the thuggy cult wants to take over the world?
Yeah, they wanted to.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, at one shadows, point when Mola Rama is explaining his plan, he's like, first we'll get the British out of here, and then we'll destroy the Muslims, and then we'll destroy the Hebrew God, and then the Christian God will be cast down, and the thuggies will rule the world.
Yeah,
okay. He's pretty open about it. Yeah.
The thuggy were in a lot of 80s media, and I don't know if that was just like a weird, like, because of Indiana Jones, like, or if it was just a general, like, throwback to pulp stuff.
I think it was an Indiana Jones thing, because... Yeah. So, are you talking about, like, Romancing the Stone or something?
No, I mean, like, they show up in, like, a lot of comics. Like, there's a big, like, thuggy plot in the 80s Suicide Squad at DC.
Was that
like
early 80s or late 80s?
87.
Okay, so probably Indiana Jones.
Probably from Indiana Jones.
So, the inspiration for Temple of Doom being set in India was basically that the writers loved India. And they loved Indian culture and art. And were just like, we want to do a movie set here. So, they looked and said, what would be appropriate for Indiana Jones, you know, first half of the 20th century before World War II. And so they set it in 1935. And, you know, I feel like there is a pretty good amount of historical context happening here that I didn't really appreciate until I started researching it. But, you know, this does take place under the sort of the waning days of the British Empire, which pretty much went away after World War II. But at this point, they still had their, you know, their stronghold in India, which they had controlled for like 200 years. And you do have kind of like the British captain showing up randomly at the dinner and then saving the day at the end with the riflemen.
Yeah, which is not.
He's just kind of there.
Yeah, the regiment commanded by the white guy come save everything at the end.
Yeah, it's one of the
things that doesn't feel great at this point. But
I don't know.
At least it takes two white guys to save the day.
Yeah.
The British were.
I mean, yeah, it's that they were in charge. They were at occupying that point still. So yeah.
But it's important to understand that, like, the Maharaja, who, you know, the kid who runs the palace under the prime minister, is not, like, the ruler of all India. India was broken into lots and lots of regions. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he was kind of like the local color, the local ruler, just for that particular region. So, so a lot of this has to do with kind of the collapse of British India and the resurgence of traditions and groups and cults and so forth that had pretty much been exterminated under the British rule. But as the British influence in India waned, then these started to make a comeback. So I feel like that part of it's actually pretty smart. Like, I think in terms of history, the context actually works there and the story makes sense. How they handle the story is another question. But the idea of like, oh yeah, the influence of the British in India was waning because they had lost their control over most of the world by that point. So naturally, as they kind of lost their power, then the groups and the religions that they tried to exterminate would finally start to bubble back up and find hold again. So, like, to me, the historical part of Temple of Doom actually makes a lot of sense. And I think it's pretty smartly conceived. The part about, you know, like ripping someone's heart out and it catching flame and drinking mind control blood, maybe not so much.
I do think there's a way to do this movie and have it be better.
No doubt.
Yeah. Again, at its absolute best, Temple of Doom is a full on white savior narrative. And I think a lot of that comes from the fact that all three of our hero characters, Indy, Willie, and Short Round, are outsiders. And I think you fix a lot of this movie if you make Willie Indian, and then there's, you know, a better connection.
She has connection of some sort.
Yeah, if there's some kind of personal investment, then and some kind of character that we like who is connected to this instead of being these outsiders that these people have to go to.
Yeah, she's literally only there because she was hoping to marry the Maharaja and become a princess until she realized, oh, that would be illegal.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe not. I don't know. Thank you.
mention the voodoo dolls, man, and how stupid that is.
I forgot about the voodoo dolls.
Freaking voodoo dolls.
Yeah, this might surprise you.
You know, the great Indian tradition of voodoo.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was...
That's trite crap, too. That's what I'm telling you.
That's bad.
It's just a lot of stuff thrown in here that's just not that great. It's like, you're making the worst possible soup. Like, let's just throw some voodoo dolls in there.
I mean, you can say it's the worst possible soup, but no. There are other much worse
soups.
Indiana Jones-derived films from the 80s. That make you realize, oh, like, Temple of Doom has some problems, but it's not complete garbage.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it has some redeeming qualities relative to those other things.
He's no Zap Rousedower.
Yeah, but we're also comparing it to some of the coolest pulp films of all time, like Raiders of the Lost Ark and Last Crusade. You know, those are really great movies as far as
they're
my generation, my, you know, cultural standpoint and everything point of view is I love those films. So we're comparing them to that, and that's a high standard to live up to.
Yeah,
and you can't go wrong with fighting Nazis, unlike all these other pulp settings.
Yeah, so yeah, we're missing out on the Nazi element here. but, it's just a bunch of, you know...
But it's also, and yeah, it's sort of...
problematic native conquering, and then these children who are running to them. And yeah, and the fact that he clings to Willie, the only reason they cling together is they're the only two white people on the ship or whatever, and then... You know, why else this lady, I don't know, why is she with him?
I don't know why they bring Willie.
She gets caught up.
They got caught up in this, yeah.
Oh, she gets dragged along because she has the antidote to the poison that he drinks at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And then he never at any point says, okay, you can leave now. He takes her on the cargo plane. I guess
which is kidnapping.
Yeah.
Although I can see where she would be like, maybe I don't want to hang out with Lao She after he's like, oh, go ahead and kill her. I'll just get another one. So
look, that's fair.
Yeah.
So I can understand why she would want to come along. But
yeah, it's just it's always going to be hard to do this kind of setting without it just being super colonialist. Because I mean, obviously, you know, it was that time. It was a time of colonialism.
It's literally a colonial
literally is
movie.
A colony. Yeah. But like just having that point of view. And I think, like Chris said, it would have helped a lot if we had had a character who lived there.
Any positive main character
would have been fantastic. You know? But as it is, it really leans into the colonialism. Like you have Harrison Ford saying things like, this is the first time anyone's seen this in 100 years, except for, you know, all the hundreds of people who actually live here. But
well, you know, it's like Discovery, like, oh, we discovered this new land that has all these brown people living here, but we discovered it.
Yeah, I mean, that was the mindset, clearly. But
it might surprise you to find out I did not rewatch this movie before we came in to do this. I haven't seen this movie in 10, 15 years. So when I say that it is technically well made, it is very memorable. Like and again, I loved Indiana Jones as a kid, and this was the one when I was a kid and we had HBO, it was about the time that this one was on all the time. Mm-hmm. So I probably saw this one as a child way more than I watched Raiders, and obviously Last Crusade wouldn't have been out
yet. Same with me.
That effed you up.
Yeah, it did me too. I mean, Chris and I are only a couple of years apart, so I was that age where when this came out, what year did this come out? 86?
84.
84, okay. Oh, yeah. So it was a couple of years later, and it was on HBO and stuff, and yeah, I saw it. I saw the whole heart ripping and everything. I saw that little Maharaja kid, like, that really bothered me when he gets, like, when he suffers later. He gets voodoo dolled, right, and stuff.
No, he's voodoo dolled.
He's the one doing the voodoo doll.
Right? I hated everything about that character because I was thinking about it as a little kid point of view. It's like, why is he hurting them? You know?
Yeah, he
why
was miming. He know, was mind control.
He drank the black blood of Kali.
Yeah, but you can't understand that when you're a kid.
And actually, I like the actor for that guy did a good job of selling it. Like he was.
But doesn't he get slugged by Indy or something at the end?
He gets slugged by Short Round, and then comes back out of the mind control.
Why did you have a kid? Well,
yeah, that's why they had a kid.
Yeah, so someone could punch.
So you can punch the kid.
Yeah, but no, there was a lot of technically excellent stuff in this film.
It looks good.
Yeah, it looks good. There's a lot. I mean, there's so much.
Except the cuts of the crocodiles. What the hell?
There's
so bad. It's like stock footage. It's so bad.
The crocodiles don't look good. But like, you know, as dumb as it is. Jumping out of the plane with the inflatable life raft and surfing it down the all it's missing is Surfing USA playing like in the James Bond movie.
Yeah, there's
but like that, it's shot really well. Like it's got that beautiful blue sky, the crisp white snow, the yellow of the raft. It looks really good. The scenes in the underground lava cavern where they're doing human sacrifice look really good. The shot, so that we're not super entirely negative. The shot of Indy with after he's done being mind controlled, when he goes and beats the shit out of the slavers, is a really great shot.
The mine cart walks up to him, or like is pushed up to him, and the lights kind of illuminate him, and he's standing against the in, like in silhouette almost.
Yeah, that is like top three shot.
That is
of Indiana
the Jim
Jones.
Steranko art.
Yes, that's the iconic Indiana Jones shot, and it's from this movie. Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of amazing effects work in this. I mean, there's a ton of just gorgeous matte painting work all over this movie. Paintings. And then some of the composite, I mean, some of it works better than others. Like some, like,
yeah, like
some
the plane
times,
crashing on the mountainside is
the plane crashing,
ooh, extremely bad,
cheesy looking.
But yeah, most of it is really
but
good.
But so there's in the ending scenes with the crocodile parts are bad, but the parts where they've got like Indy fighting and dangling over the canyon. So the canyon, I saw this once when I was a kid in a special about how they were making things. And so lots of the canyon bits were matte paintings. But they had things where the actual set that Indian was on wasn't really long enough. So his legs dangled past the end of the set and like into the matte painting. And so what they actually had to do is they went in by hand and like blacked out indie leg shaped bits of the matte painting on every frame for like an entire 10 second shot so they could composite his legs dangling over the canyon. Wow. And it works. Like you don't even notice, like if you're really looking for it, you can tell something's going on there. But
man, there I thought that was in a real canyon.
I mean, I'm sure there were some actual canyon shots in some parts, but a lot of it was matte paintings.
That's great.
No, it's a very well made movie. I feel like there's just some problems with the writing. Mm-hmm. And that's really, you know, at the heart of it, that's what makes the indie movies great when they're at their best is that they're just so well written. And there definitely are those moments where you're like, oh, it's classic indie. But I feel like sometimes they try to sell it a little hard with the dun, 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 dun. You get that little leitmotif. John Williams is like, I'm doing my best for you, George. I'm trying so hard. God damn it. And it just doesn't quite sell it. But I don't know. Like this movie still was profoundly influential. And I think the first thing we should talk about is the fact that it was extremely violent, extremely gory by the context of its time. It was a PG-rated movie when it first started. PG means if you are like 8 years old, go see it. It's fine. If you are 8 years old, you should not go see this movie. And maybe by today's standards, okay. But at the time, like, you know, the heart-ripping and the gore and the shooting and the punching and all the violence. It was
drinking the black blood of Kali.
Monkey brains. That's apparently a real thing.
Sure. I mean, somewhere. Okay.
I just had a friend of mine tell me about that. Yeah.
Frank Zappa would be proud. So like it was a very controversial movie at the time. And this was one of two movies that I want to say helped inspire the PG-13 rating.
Is it this in Gremlins?
Or maybe Gremlins was also way up there. Mm-hmm. But I remember
it should be a hard R.
I remember this movie when it first came out. I went up to visit my grandparents on vacation, and I saw a big, you know, cover story on the newspaper. One section of the newspaper, the entertainment section, just talking about like PG-13 ratings are coming, and it's because of this new movie, Indiana Jones. Don't take your kids to see this. It's really violent and dark. So I didn't get to see it for a few years. And when I finally got to see it, I was like, that's pretty violent and dark. Yeah.
Dark is a great way to describe it.
Yeah. I mean, I really,
the supernatural elements of the black blood of Kali and how it takes people over and it makes them want to rip people's hearts out and stuff is like super dark, sinister, kind of like an idea that really torments you more than the visuals in a way. You know what I mean?
You know, when I was researching this, I read that this movie happened around the time of George Lucas's divorce. And so a lot of the stuff that he was working through personally kind of came out in the tone of the movie. And I don't know how much truth there is to that, but
like his wife ripping his heart out.
I mean, yeah, if you want to be literal about it, sure.
Really, really would explain Willie.
Yeah.
I mean, there may be some things that he's kind of, you know, the writing is kind of working through there. In any case, it is a really dark movie compared to anything else Lucas had done to that point. And I feel like there was this kind of push toward darker and darker media in the 80s as people began to, you know, just see what you could get away with in Reagan's America. But this definitely, it crossed the line, and they really pulled back with future indie movies. They were like, let's make it happier and lighter. I mean, Lucas actually said, or maybe it was Spielberg, said that The Last Crusade was an apology for Temple of Doom.
Yeah, that makes sense, because Last Crusade is very much a, in the way that comics will do, like a back to basics reboot. Like, it's very much a back to basics Indiana Jones movie. You know, it's got two different kind of opening set pieces. It's got the young Indy set piece, and then it's got the sequence on the beach. It's got Indy as a professor again, which we don't see in Temple of Doom. Nazis, obviously. And then the ending with Donovan drinking from the false grail is very evocative of, but way less gross than the ending of Raiders. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, like, he gets old and dusty and dies. He doesn't melt with blood shooting out of his eyes.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like Temple of Doom is almost a horror movie in some of just compared to those, you know, it's got like horror, very dark horror elements.
I agree. And I can't, you know, resent the creators for going in that direction, because I feel like it was a natural kind of direction to take this sort of movie, given its influences and its roots and everything. But, you know, everyone kind of needs to experiment and see, like, what works, what doesn't. This definitely didn't work, but I understand why they went in this direction.
When did Nightmare on Elm Street come out?
I want to say that was like 85, 86.
Okay, so that's after this? Because I feel like that's, you know, the Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street were really big in the 80s, around this time, maybe a couple of years later. So I'm wondering if there's any relation of, like, there was a tone going towards, like, oh, some horror movies are really doing well. Maybe
that
was
84, actually.
In a horror movie, you know?
You would have had, like, the kind of rise of, you know, slasher movies in the late 70s. Mm-hmm. And like, I feel like there's a lot of just general gross out stuff in the 80s. Like, you know, even Jedi, Return of the Jedi has, like, Jabba's gross. Yeah, like, Jabba's gross. Really gross.
I was thinking about that. Yeah.
Jabba's actually. Tongue.
I mean, yeah, like the confluence of serial adventure action and horror was not a new idea. I mean, Alien was basically Star Wars 2001, Star Trek, whatever, meets, you know, Jason, basically, Friday the 13th.
But I think that
Leatherface.
I do think there's a big difference, though, because when we talk about Raiders, there's the scene at the end where the Nazis melt. There's the, when they put them in the pit and there's the bunch of snakes on the floor, the asps, like, that's not really gross, but, you know, if you're afraid of snakes, it is, I guess. In Last Crusade, there's really just, you know, the false grail at the end.
Well, there's rats.
There's the rats.
Yeah. Rats.
Oh, rats.
Yeah.
Like, that's the good kind of triangle.
Never made it past the rats. I like that
one. But in Temple of Doom, it is throughout.
Yeah.
Like, the eyeball soup and chilled monkey brains is pretty early in the
ridiculous.
Film.
Ridiculous.
Yeah. And that's like the second, you know, quote unquote, gross mealtime scene.
Right. And then there's the bug scene.
The bug scene.
There's the human sacrifice.
There's people being burned alive. And then there's just like
the guy being squished in the rock roller, who, by the way, is the same actor as the large German mechanic and the swordsman in the marketplace in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
I didn't know that.
He was a very versatile large guy who died.
But yeah, there's a lot of like horror movie gross out stuff throughout Temple of Doom, as opposed to just being like, it is climactic in Raiders when it happens, because we haven't seen anything like that.
Yeah.
By the time the Maharaj is using the voodoo doll, it's like, yeah, of course he is. Why not?
Yeah.
I will say the crushing ceiling with the spike scene is also a pretty good scene. Like, with, especially with Indy telling Willie, like, we're going to die.
I mean, taken on their own, almost all the scenes, the action scenes and set pieces are pretty good. It's just when you add them all together. I mean, even Lucas said, like, they wanted to go darker, but then they put everything together and were like, oh, we went too far. Like, that was too dark.
There's like child slaves being whipped in this movie.
No, I mean,
like,
this is a movie where they turn Indy's whip against him. I think that's significant. Like, there is a scene where they use his whip to slash his back, to whip him, to abuse him. And, you know, it struck me while I was watching this that it's significant that they gave Indy a whip as his primary weapon, because it's not really a lethal weapon. It causes pain. It can definitely inflict injury. But aside from the guy who chokes himself on the ceiling fan with his whip, like, the whip doesn't kill. So, it's a way to soften the hero. Like, he doesn't use his gun very much in this movie.
And he very rarely uses his whip, like, against people.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, I mean, it's like to scare people off.
Swinging implement.
Yeah.
It's utility, but yeah.
Right, it's utility, it's self-defense, but it says a lot about the character. But then to take that away from him and then use it against him to injure him, to abuse and punish him, torture him, like, that's, to me, that says something significant about this movie that I don't think I've ever really seen anyone comment on. But watching it this morning, I was like, there's something about this that is very unsettling.
And that happens right next to the same sequence where they then give him the mind control drug and turn Indy himself against his friends.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a part
of the Hey kids, do you like Indiana Jones? Want to see him get tortured and then try to murder a child?
Want to see him slap a kid around and send a woman to her death? Well, that's what we're here for.
So the whole time the viewer is presumably
maybe George Lucas could do some journaling.
Yeah, George Lucas, you silly man. So the viewer is identifying with Indy this whole time. We've identified with him as the hero through the last film, and so they are turning him against us. So it's sort of like torturing the viewer. The viewer gets tortured through Indy. The viewer gets turned against his friends through Indy. And maybe that's one of the most disconcerting things about the film. Hmm. I think Jeremy's right.
Yeah, yeah. I absolutely agree with you. So we have a lot of complaints about this movie. Okay, here's production trivia. I wrote this down. Ford spent 7 weeks recuperating from surgery to rectify a hernia. So that is why when he's moving around sometimes, you're like, is he okay? He's not okay. So... that is neither here nor there, but yeah, just call back to what I was talking about earlier.
I wonder if they added in the whipping to kind of justify it, but that happens pretty late in the film, right?
Yeah, it's near the end.
Yeah.
They could have filmed that earlier on.
I mean, it's before the minecart set pieces, but
that's true. He should have been
Most of the action scenes are performed by his stunt double, who has the best name ever, Vic Armstrong.
It's pretty good.
Excellent. I mean, he was born to be a Hollywood stuntman.
If only he would have been like, oh, jumping out of that plane on that life raft really hurt my back.
Right? Yeah. It doubles as a parachute.
So one of the things that I think is interesting about this movie is there was only ever one video game based actually directly on this movie, aside from a segment in the Super NES game that we all hate. But this movie has been so influential. There's so much of this movie that appears in other things. Like, Benji, you talked about how the minecart scene was trite. But had there been a minecart scene like this in a movie before?
Not that I know.
This was like, it was a
maybe
very...
Maybe in like a 30s serial or something.
Yeah, but like it was that. Like super primitive and bad. Whereas this is like fast-paced, intense. There's great staging. Like, you can see where the threats are, where the heroes are in relation to the threats.
Yeah, it feels like a video game sequence,
well,
actually.
This video... It seems trite now in the same way that the Beatles seem trite, because everyone has looked at this and been like, hell yes, we're doing this. I think it's interesting that there is one jump in the minecart sequence that they don't have any control over. It's like, oh God, there's a gap in the traps, the gap in the tracks.
We got to jump.
And no, they don't even jump. They're just like, duck and hope we don't die. But when you see minecart sequences in video games, it's always about like jumping. But the mechanic here to keep them safe is braking so they don't go around a bend too fast and fly off into the lava or the magma. Sorry. Yeah. So I don't know, like, this has been, it's one of the most widely imitated movie scenes ever, even more so than the giant rolling boulder at the beginning of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah.
But no one does it the same way it's done actually here.
I got the same feeling with a lot of the action set pieces in this as from Goonies that we talked about last year, in that there were a bunch...
Which also starred Jonathan Kwan.
Yes, which also starred Jonathan Kwan.
He's the grand unifying theory here.
The action hero.
But there's a bunch of little set pieces that just seem like they're designed either to be a video game level or to be an amusement park ride level, Right. And then like they're just done. So they work as a movie, but they also work when adapted to do like these other things.
I feel like this predates the idea of doing that for video games.
Steven Spielberg loved video games. He had arcade machines office.
You didn't really see video games done like this at the time.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
Yeah,
that's.
But
all
intentionally set up to be a video game, but sort of to be an encapsulated action sequence that you could make into something else, like an amusement park ride, and then those same qualities lent themselves to making into an individual video game or game level.
Yeah, maybe I think Ben's onto something here about the amusement park as a sort of idiom for a whole complete action experience, beginning, end, and middle. I never thought about that before. Video games, you're learning this. Fascinating, Ben. I think you should write a book about this.
It's
great. And it's, amusement park ride, it hits all of the most obvious tones of an experience. It's not subtle in any way. It's just the most extreme things coming at you, and a summary of something, because it doesn't last very long, and that's like a video game. You got these high points that you hit, and then it's over.
I feel like there's something there, but as a result of that, you definitely see little fragments of this movie in video games, like the crushing room with the bugs and everything. Mm-hmm, like I feel like I've seen that in a lot of games. The bridge fight at the end. Like whenever I watch that now, like that takes me to Metal Gear Solid 3 with the big long bridge that you have to go across, and it's like a key part of sort of the opening chapter of that game, because you go across it and then you come back on the other side, and like there's pretty big plot things that happen. And
don't forget Donkey Kong Country.
The minecart we've already talked about. Like,
I mean, Mega Man has a minecart level.
It does.
Well, like the minecart.
The like in like Mega Man, what was that, 7? The like
no video game after Donkey Kong Country should have used minecarts, because no one's done anything new with it.
I hate them
so much. And of course, the minecart sequence appears in one of the video games based on this movie. That is Indiana Jones' Greatest Adventure, which has 4 stages based on Temple of Doom. Yeah, we're jumping straight to the video games now, so we can wind this podcast down. It's kind of it's a very condensed sort of take on Temple of Doom. Like a quarter of the segment consists of just Club Obi-Wan, the place in Shanghai. And
Club Obi-Wan?
Yeah,
are you joking?
You didn't know that?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, at the very end when they're driving away, it says Club Obi-Wan.
Man, that's trite.
It's a blink and you miss it reference. You didn't even notice. So how trite is that?
I'm glad I didn't notice. It would have made me hate this film more than I do. Now, what platform is this Greatest Adventures thing?
Super NES. Okay. It's the same one that Raiders of the Lost Ark is in. And it hates you. It's by Factor 5.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
They want
we
you
were
to
playing
die.
This last year at your house. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the first stage is Club Obi-Wan. And you start out in the interior. And you're basically like, it's just a running, jumping kind of thing. And
like a beat 'em up more, but...
Sort of, but the sort of main gimmick there is that people's Tommy gun targeting reticles are tracking you, so you can't stay in one place too long. And then the second half of it, you're outside Club Obi-Wan trying to like jump around on awnings because, they fall through like 3 awnings. So that translates into an entire level based around awnings. It's very much like Aladdin on Super NES.
Yep. Yeah. Also, you're wearing your regular Indiana Jones outfit instead of the tuxedo.
Suddenly. Well, yeah.
As one does. I mean, that would have been another sprite. They only had so much realm space. The second stage is a Mode 7 life raft first-person slide where you're avoiding trees and leaving pits. And then that just goes directly into the palace. I made some notes here. I don't remember the palace part, but it says there's a teleportation maze.
Yeah, well, so I watched a little bit of this. I haven't actually played it. But it looks like a real pain because you're pushing around these statues and urns, and
do
sometimes
you press them by their chest.
I don't even know. But like sometimes you have to push urns so that you can jump over a statue so that it doesn't teleport you. But it seems like you have to get the statues in the right place in order to walk behind them to teleport to somewhere else. And it seems like incredibly obtuse.
So stage 3 is the Mola Ram Kali Shrine, and you have to avoid magma. And then there you're fighting through the mines, but have to rescue the kids as you do so. And they are worth 500 points, in case you were wondering what a human life is worth. 500
points. So that's what it is, yeah.
And then the final stage is, of course, the minecart sequence, which is a rail shooter. You don't have to jump around. So it's the one minecart sequence in video games that is true to the Temple of Doom experience, which is appropriate. And then there is a kind of like a final showdown. I have never played this part and never want to, just watching videos of it. You have to fight a guard who is blocking the end of the bridge, and any plank that you step on falls away. So you have to fight this guy while constantly jumping around and gradually having less and less surface to land on.
And the whole thing like wobbles too.
It's like, terrible.
Yeah, it sounds like a nightmare.
It looks like a literal nightmare.
Yeah. Like,
it's kind of like a clever conceit the way they did, but it looks like just complete BS to actually try to play.
So that is one video game interpretation of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. But the more notable one is, in fact, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom by Atari, which came out in like 1985, 86. I didn't seem to have written it down, but this one got a few conversions, home ports, including to NES through Tengen, because it was an Atari game and therefore was published by Tengen. And this one is based entirely around the sequence in which Indy rescues the kids from the mines. That is the entirety of the game. Have you guys? I feel like you must have played this one.
Played it, yeah, but I didn't like it.
Did you play the arcade version or the NES version?
Probably a home port of some kind or another. I know I've played the NES one. I may have played the arcade one, you know, on an emulator. But I don't have much to say about it. I think I didn't like it, so I stopped playing it. What about you, Ben?
I haven't actually played it. I watched some of it. Yeah, it has some of the worst speech synthesis I have ever heard. Not that it's technically bad, but the lines were, you know, delivered by an intern who didn't care.
Yeah, it's the kind of game that was
actually a pretty big genre for a while, which is just kind of wander around these large interconnected spaces without much direction, trying to collect all the things you need to collect to get out of the level, which can be done well, but I don't know. Didn't look like a very inspiring implementation of it.
I feel like this game is very much of its time,
yeah,
the mid-80s, where, it's kind of, I guess it was 80. It was one of Atari's first games once they split off into Atari Games. So
the arcade division.
Yes, the Atari, the arcade division. So along with like Paperboy and Marble Madness, I don't think it's as good as those games, but it like those games, it is also kind of an isometric perspective, sort of fake 3D. So you have these sort of like platforms you can run around on and lots of slides and ladders and so forth.
Yeah. It's got a very chutes and ladders kind of layout to it, but it also looked like that would just be really annoying because you get on these slot these chutes and you'll have to, like, I assume you're holding left or right to decide which way you go when there's splits in the chutes, so you can end up sliding right past something you wanted to get and then like, oh whoops, I was holding the right direction, I missed that, now I've got to walk halfway around the level to get back to the top of the slide and come do it again so I can actually rescue the kid. It looked kind of tedious, honestly.
I think game is unremarkable. It's like one of those things where you don't need to know about it or ever play it. It's one of the 1001 games you don't need to play before you die.
Nope.
You have no thoughts on this whatsoever?
No. It's weird. Like, with as much as they go from set piece to set piece, you'd think the Indiana Jones games would be really easy to adapt into video games. Turns out they are not.
Well, I think next episode, next Indiana Jones episode, we'll figure out how they cracked the code eventually.
Oh, I know.
And the trick is not to make an action game, surprisingly enough.
Yep. But we're not going to spoil it for you now.
No, you'll have to wonder. Yeah. Like, you can't possibly read about the history of video games. You have to wait until our next Retronauts episode.
Print is dead.
But yeah, I feel like they with the arcade game, they just took a single moment of the movie, which, you know, in fairness, that happened a lot. Like, the Star Wars arcade game took a moment of the movie, but God damn, that was amazing. It was such a fun game. It took the best part of the movie, the attack on the Death Star. It's so good.
Did you know, though, those X-Wing fighter pilots trained their whole lives to do that? So that was a whole thing, you know?
I mean,
nobody sat around and trained how to rescue little orphans from a mine.
I mean, Luke Skywalker didn't train. He could bullseye some womp rats in a C-16 back home, but...
It's a paradigm, you know,
this wasn't Beggar's Canyon, man.
Yeah, that was a setting that could lend itself to a whole game. Because you could fly a plane anywhere and shoot anything as much as you want, because it's a whole thing. Rescuing little kids from a mine is not a thing like that.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
I guess so.
Chris, back me up on
it. No, I get what you're saying. There's an entire genre of video game that's flying around and shooting things.
Yeah.
So basically what we needed to do was give Pac-Man like a little hat and a whip. And have him go around in the maze.
What they should have done is
licensed Pitfall. I feel like there was an episode
Pitfall.
Of the Pac-Man cartoon where Pac-Man had a hat. He already had a hat.
Yeah.
But a jacket and a whip. I bet he did.
They should have licensed a Pitfall sequel or clone or something and stuck Indiana Jones in there. That would have been more appropriate if they just made like a new Pitfall Harry, but with Indiana Jones.
That was an Activision game, and they hated Atari.
Yeah, plus they were, this is like 1984 or something when they were going bankrupt and stuff. So
this was 86, I'm pretty sure.
Well, I mean, when the movie came out, you know, it wasn't.
Right.
Didn't you say, what year was Temple of Doom? 84?
84, yeah.
Yeah, so that was the worst possible time for Activision to make anything after the crash and everything. So anyway, there you go.
Right. And then Bobby Kotick was like, no, I don't want to license this game out.
He was but a wee babe back then.
So I feel like we should say some more about the arcade game, because
is this all we have to talk about, these two games?
Yeah, there weren't a lot of games. Like I said, the legacy of Temple of Doom is really much more about how it's been digested and repurposed for other games as opposed to the games that are based directly on it.
What's your favorite minecart sequence?
I don't have one. Well, okay, I like the ones in Klonoa. Where basically there's no danger to it. It's just a bonus stage. And if you jump just right, then you'll get all the gems. And that's nice. But if you don't, okay.
You know, there was a minecart sequence in that new the Labo, Nintendo Labo Toy-Con house thing. There's some kind of like, when you build the house, there's a little creature and you push these buttons on the side of the cardboard house and he goes into a minecart or something and jumps in. Crazy. So the most recent minecart sequence I've seen in a video game.
Is there a Mario game with a minecart sequence? Like a Paper Mario has a minecart sequence or something?
I can't think of anything. There is a Final Fantasy with a minecart sequence.
Final Fantasy VI minecart sequence, yeah.
Why? Why would you do that? It just doesn't make any sense.
To like do some weird abstract mode set background.
There's no danger to that
just,
one either.
It's just a bunch of random encounters. Well, not random encounters. It's a bunch of set encounters as you do some mode 7 stuff in the background.
For some reason, when I think of Temple of Doom, I think of there was like a ZX Spectrum. I'm going to say it the right way. ZX Spectrum game.
Well done. Absolutely cracking.
Cheerio, old chap. And so there was some kind of port on the ZX Spectrum that was notable for people in the UK. So if anyone out there is listening to this, just tell us if I'm right or not.
Wait, a Temple of Doom game?
Yeah, I feel like it was. Like,
was it a, with the was mine it a conversion
carts.
Of the...
No, not the minecarts, the rescuing kids. I think it was
so
like
a conversion
of
the arcade game, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was ported to a bunch of systems. Yeah.
I feel like, I don't know why, but that version of this sticks out in my brain. So there must be something remarkable about it, and I don't know what it is.
Just love
like
that, you love that color clash.
I love the yellow and red, magenta.
And cyan.
Yeah.
It's like going to a print shop.
It's awesome. It's like CGA all over again.
So for crediting this movie for like all the minecart levels, do we also get it to credit?
No, it's blaming
for all the minecart. Do we also get to blame it for like all the snowboarding levels because of the raft sequence?
Maybe.
I don't know.
I feel like that exists in a larger concept, whereas minecarts, really like the idea of minecart as an action vehicle, that was pretty much this movie.
I think, you're safe. It's safe to say that it came from this.
All right. Well, I don't know that we've necessarily done justice to this topic, but maybe we've done too much justice. I don't know. I'm tired of talking about it. We had to get through this one so we could talk about Last Crusade. I'm looking forward to that. That'll be a hoot. In the meantime, though, this has been Retronauts talking about Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom and how problematic it is with a capital P. So anyway, thanks for listening. Yes, that's correct. You have been listening. I have been Jeremy Parrish, to whom you have been listening. This has been Retronauts. Retronauts can be found on the internet at retronauts.com and on iTunes and on other services and so on and so forth. If for some reason you thought this was an amazing episode, God bless you. You can support Retronauts by going to Patreon, patreon.com/retronauts, and subscribing to us. You get to hear these amazing episodes 3 weeks, or no, sorry, 1 week early with better bitrate quality and no advertisements. Boy, I think this...
And 30% more farting noises.
No, absolutely not. I guess that's what the higher bitrate gets you. I don't know. This episode took a lot out of me. I can't remember even what's happening. Someone else talk.
I think we did a very good job on this episode, Jeremy. I think we were all very entertaining.
I think so, too. I think it's just this topic itself.
It's a depressing topic.
It's really tough.
It's a little too dark. We should do a podcast that's less dark next time.
I wanted to do a little bit of dark, but then I saw this episode all together and I was like, oh, we went too dark.
Yeah.
I feel you, George Lucas.
Thanks a lot, George. So I'm Benj Edwards. You can find me anywhere you look because I'm all around you at all times. No, bxfoundry.com. I've been building joysticks for old video game systems, and you can find me at Benj Edwards on Twitter. And Ben?
I'm Ben Elgin. I'm just lurking in the darkness right now, but also on Twitter, at Kieran, K-I-R-I-N-N, on Twitter.
I'm Chris Sims. You can find me on that bad website as at the ISB. You can also go to the-isb.com and find me, because that is a website where anything goes.
Back to the good part.
Whatever happens at the ISB stays at the ISB, right?
Well, hopefully not, because it is mostly links to other places where you can find my work.
Oh, damn.
Welcome
That's
home,
why
old
your
boy.
Traffic is so bad.
All right, everyone. Just so you're clear, when I make deprecating comments about this podcast, it's about my performance as a host. I feel like I could have brought this into brighter, happier spaces, but I failed, and I apologize for that.
We'll save that up for the
But you know, at least this podcast didn't literally rip your heart out, only figuratively. Anyway, thanks everyone for listening. Next time we talk about Raiders or Indiana Jones, it'll be so good and so happy. Just look forward to it. You're going to love it. I promise.
Remember, everyone, in the Latin alphabet, Jeremy Parrish begins with an I.